This is the third in a series of classes I've been working on related to morality and economic life. Today I want to talk about markets and communities. So let me just say a couple words, sort of foundational things, and then we'll get into it a little more. So over the course of the week, what I've been trying to do is think about different views of capitalism. You know, there's this idea of capitalism as creating opportunity and growth and pulling people out of poverty and being good. On the other extreme, there's this idea of capitalism as being exploitive and taking advantage of people. And I've been trying to urge people in my classes this week to think about the gray areas in the middle. And capitalism is both good and bad, and how can we structure our institutions and rules and relations with each other to draw out the good and kind of reform the bad parts of capitalism. And so I want to continue with that today and talk about a topic that I've become really interested in over the last year or so, but I'm going to tell you right now, I know almost nothing about it. It's kind of difficult, but I've been, like I said, it's caught my interest, and I've been doing a lot of reading over the last year or so on this question of markets and how they affect community or how they affect our relationships with each other. And so what we're going to do is I've got some ideas, a couple discussion points, but a lot of what I want to do today is just kind of make some observations and share some of what I've learned over the last year or so and get your response and see if collectively we can make sense of these things. And it gets us into a lot of things like psychology and neuroscience. It's really fascinating stuff, but I could tell you right now, I don't know what I'm talking about. So I'll just sort of organize the discussion and see where it goes. So by way of background, let me sort of give you a sense of how I think about this. So in the very first economics class that a lot of people take, we talk about specialization and exchange. It's sort of the foundation of economics, right? We trade with each other. And the reason we do that is because there's some mutual gain with that, right? I have an apple, I sell it to you, you give me some money, the apple's worth more than the money you gave me, the money I guess worth more than the apple to me, and we're all better off. There's a sense of mutual gain from exchange, right? And throughout much of human history that happened, but exchange took place among people in a small community, among kin, among, you know, within the tribe, neighbors, close associates. And so that exchange we have to take for granted, but exchange has to be grounded in trust, in cooperation. And if we don't trust each other, it's really difficult for that sort of exchange to take place. And we do it every single day, and I think we take that trust for granted. But, you know, I go to the store and I give them money for a package of some kind of food, and I trust that what is in the package is what they say it is, and it's good and it's not going to hurt me, right? And they trust that my check is good to some degree. And so there's a lot of trust that goes into that. And so much of history, we just traded and exchanged with people who we trusted. The specialization part of specialization exchange complicates that, I think. So, over time, we learn to specialize in things. Like I currently am specializing in economics. I teach economics, right? I have very few skills to actually keep myself alive, which is sort of scary. I can't build things. I can't build shelter. I can't feed myself very well. So what I do is I teach economics, and fortunately somebody's paying me for that, and then I can take the money and I can buy the things I need to stay alive, right? And so most of us do that. We specialize in something that by itself is not going to sustain us. But when we can do that and then exchange with each other, it works. Right? But the more specialized you get, and this here's where the tension comes in, the more specialized you get, the broader the audience of people you have to exchange with, right? And so I've realized there are a very limited number of people in the world who actually want to hear an economics lecture, right? And so in order to find enough people who want to listen to me that Luther will pay my salary, we have to expand the group of people that we exchange with. Right, and many of you are probably or have been in sort of niche specialized industries, right? And so your market has to grow. But when we do that, all of a sudden we're trading with strangers. We're not trading with our neighbors and our community members and our kin anymore. We're trading with strangers. We have become an economy of strangers, right? And so where does that trust and cooperation come from? I think this is the sort of the interesting tension that I want to explore a little bit. So, you know, one way to think about the question today is, you know, does an economy of strangers erode our trust and cooperation and care for each other? Or not? Or to put it another way, if you have studied any economics, you'll know that one of the foundational assumptions of economics is that we are self-interested, that people sort of and I don't mean selfish, I want to be very careful, that doesn't necessarily mean selfish, but self-interested means that I sort of have some objectives, I know what I want to do, and I make rational choices in order to accomplish those goals, but I'm thinking of my own self-interest. That's the foundational assumption of economics, and people get very, and that's the way I was taught, and that's the way I often teach, but my students rightfully get uncomfortable with that, because we are not fully self-interested. Right, but then the question becomes, well, if our system is sort of grounded in this assumption of self-interest, does that system actually create greater self-interest and erode the altruism that we might normally feel toward each other? So that's my question today, and it's a big one, and I'm not sure exactly how to get at it. But I've got a couple of things I want to do that might sort of open up discussion. So let me start with the question. So how many of you try to shop locally? No, it's a large percentage. Why?
I grew up in rural town. Farm.
Okay, good.
And, yeah, a lot of relationship oriented stuff. Mm-hmm. Care for one another. What's the bias?
So I'm trying to understand. So you grew up in that kind of economy. You're continuing it because it's comfortable or sort of habit, or is there an actual? Do you think there are some benefits to doing so?
I think the benefits because it gives a living to people. But my interest goes beyond people and exchange of goods, it goes to the land, or care for the land, because it keeps people in this local economy accustomed to being in a white king land. Mm-hmm. So to keep them in that area with an economy that supports people in that area, it also supports the care for.
There are a lot of things in there. That's a sort of a rich answer, right? But there's an element of if we do shop locally, it's going to support the people around us, especially in a rural farm community. It's going to keep people there. It's good for the community in some way. But there are also some richer ideas there of caring for the land and caring for each other. Right? So other observations. So especially the shop locally. Why do you do that?
Well, at some level, there is a self-interest in it to maintain variety, to maintain certain opportunities for that exchange that may disappear if you don't support what are traditionally smaller businesses in the world that is becoming more and more consolidated to large.
Yeah, so I live in a small town with a Walmart out on the edge of town, right? And this comes up a lot. Well, if I go buy my duct tape at Walmart, then the local hardware store is going to go out of business,
right,
kind of thing, and I don't want that to happen.
Right, or we could all buy everything from Amazon and there would be no stores.
Yeah, okay, yeah, exactly. So why have Main Street when you've got Amazon? I feel that tension too. I use Amazon. It's super convenient when you're in a small town in rural Iowa, but at the same time, I worry about the impact of that. Yeah.
Well, the other reason to buy locally is environmental, and particularly food. Mm-hmm. Your transportation costs associated with shipping all over the country in terms of use of hydrocarbons, and carbon footprint is a lot smaller.
Yeah, although that's a complicated one too. A pickup truck full of carrots from the local farmer might actually burn more fossil fuel than like a cargo container of pineapples coming from Hawaii. I mean, it becomes so efficient, right? I mean, like per unit. But you're right, I think. There are definitely some environmental issues at work there. Other than a few other comments.
I think it makes us feel good. We don't feel guilty when we buy. You don't get that tinge of guilt.
Yeah, Do you have a sense of what's that source of guilt?
Culture,
yeah. So someone just told you that buying from Amazon or Walmart or buying a tomato from Costa Rica in the middle of February is somehow wrong, yeah.
Something for me is like the personal interaction of interacting with someone. I don't even necessarily care in some situations if I'm buying something that's come from a very long ways away, but if it's sold through a local venue and I'm fostering a relationship with that seller or that person, that's really important to me.
Yeah, I agree.
And there's like this romaine scare recently. If you buy local and your local thing gets polluted, you can buy, the next farm over. Whereas if all of your romaine comes from Yuma and it gets polluted, you're out of romaine for several months. Mm-hmm. Just the diversity of sources.
Yeah. These are all good comments. I've struggled with this question for a long time. And, one of the arguments you often hear is sort of the one you were making, that you buy local and it's going to be healthier for the community. That is one that I do struggle with. See, there's some logic to it, but you run into the issues of how you define what's the scope of the community, right? And you can expand or contract your definition of community. It becomes really complicated. But the argument that I find most persuasive is the one that I've heard a couple times here, that it just feels good. I like doing business with people I know. Something feels good about that. And I think there's something there, and what that is, I'm not sure, but somehow related to what we're talking about today, I think. So I'm going to sort of get us into, see if we can make sense of this. I'm going to get us into some of these issues I've been reading about, and see if we can make some sense of it. So I'm going to do just a short little exercise. This is a very common, so let me back up a second. So economists, fortunately, have begun to realize that people are not always self-interested, and that our models and our way of thinking about the world has to reflect that, right? And so one of the ways we do this is through experiments, usually of graduate students. They're sort of the guinea pigs of economics. And so this is a very well-worn experiment. We're not going to do the actual experiment because I would have to give you money and I don't have any. So you're going to have, it's sort of hypothetical, you're going to have to pretend, okay? So find somebody sitting next to you. You need a partner. Good? Okay, so one of you, this is called the ultimatum game, but I'll explain it to you. It's very simple. So one of you is the offerer. And I think, let's say, whoever's sort of closest to the village center can be considered the offerer. Okay, and the other one is the receiver. Okay, so the offerer, you have to imagine as realistically as you can that I just gave you $10. Okay, so all the offerers in the room were just given a $10, 10 ones, or $10. Okay, this is the way the game goes. So the offerer now takes that $10, and you have the opportunity to give any amount of that $10 to the person sitting next to you, anywhere between 0 and 10, and however you want to split it up. Okay, so you can give them 0, you can give them all 10, you can give them anything in between. Okay. The receiver then, once the offer decides how much you're going to get, or how much you're going to give, the receiver looks at that amount, and you can either accept it, in which case the money, the $10 is split up that way, the game's over, or the receiver says, no, I'm going to reject the amount you just gave me. And if you do that, neither of you get anything. All the money comes back. And I've done this in my class sometimes with like points on homework and things like that. So you try to motivate it with like real stuff. And see, so try to imagine that you're using real money, okay? So offer, take a couple seconds and think about how much am I going to give, then tell the receiver what that is, and then the receiver I'll either accept, in which case you split it, or you reject, in which case nobody gets anything. And then I want to hear how this came out, okay? So take a second to do that.
We come from a community property state.
Yeah, well, if you live in a community property state.
For example, if I offer five, and the person accepts it.
Then you each get five. Yep. So the total amount is going to have to add up to 10 when we're in there. Yeah. Unless there's rejection, then it adds up to 0.
You can do cents, right?
You can do it in cents. You can split it up however you want. Okay, everybody. So give me a sample. Let's quickly like go around the room. Offers. How much did you give?
Five.
Four. 333. How much up there? So you gave six?
I got six.
Oh, you chose, wow, okay.
Four.
Yeah, this is very Holden-esque. Yeah. Okay, so receivers, did you accept or reject those offers?
Oh, I took it.
I accept.
Anybody reject their offer?
I did.
Okay, what were you offered?
Five.
You were offered five and you rejected it?
Yes.
Why?
Because I just did it for the sake of discussion.
Okay, good. That I respect. Okay, good. So explain your reasons, offers. Explain your reasoning when you were deciding how much to give, what were you thinking?
Five was fair.
And I'll end up with at least five. You know what I mean? If I offered six, if I offered four, I might have nothing.
So five guaranteed that that they would accept it.
Yeah. Plus, she's my wife, and we split everything.
Yeah, I should have asked you to do it with a stranger. Yeah, there's too much history in this room to do this. Well, other thoughts? Yeah.
I gave four because it preserves my position relative to his position in terms of future investment, and gives me seemingly the advantage, maintains the advantage.
Okay, good.
I thought a third was fair.
So again, fairness was motivating.
Some is better than none.
Some is better enough. I mean, what interest has he got, right?
Right. So let's flip to the receiver side. So you all except for the devil's advocate over here, you all accepted it. Was there an amount where you would have rejected it?
Zero.
Yeah.
Zero? How much?
Anything less than five, I would have rejected.
Really? Okay, others? Would you, what if you offered them two?
I don't know if I would have taken
it. Three?
I took 333, but
it was
on the cusp of it. Because there's something gratifying about, like, oh, he gives me a bad deal. Well, he doesn't get any of the money.
Yeah.
Why does he, you know, if he's not going to share, why should he have that amount, too?
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Assuming the receiver knew that $10 was in the play.
Yeah.
And that it wasn't.
Yep. Everybody knows what's going on. So let me back up a second. Let's do a moment of economic theory. So if you are all truly rationally self-interested, there's economists always are looking for equilibrium. How would this game have come out? What's the equilibrium in this game if you're all truly self-interested? What should the offerers have done?
Offer less than half.
How much less than half?
$4.
Depends on how self-interested you are.
I would have gone even lower, I think. Right? I mean, if you were like a textbook, a rationally self-interested person, the caricature that we put in economics textbooks, what would you offer?
1 cent.
A penny.
Right.
Because why? Because the receiver should accept a penny because they're better off. That's better than zero. Knowing that they'll accept that, you want to keep as much as possible. If everybody is truly looking out for themselves, you get something about a very small amount, right? But when we do these experiments consistently across countries, across religions, across race, across whatever context you do it, it doesn't turn out that way. Most offers are between 30 and 50% of the amount that's there. And receivers tend to accept anything over 20 or 25%. Below that, they start rejecting at very high rates. So why is that? What does that tell us about people and how rational we are. How do you interpret those results? Yeah.
I just want to say, so you didn't go to George Mason University and have James Buchanan as your teacher, obviously.
Yeah, I did not go there, but yeah. So interpret those results for me.
I think Travis's point is it's sort of punitive. Okay, I mean, so if I'm gonna take a dollar, well, you're getting $9. Does that seem fair? Well, so it's punitive, right? You can say, I'll reject the dollar because you're not going to get $9 and we're all going to lose.
Yeah, I think you both have a really good point. So this is one of the first significant observations from this game is that we are willing to spend money or act against our own self-interest to enforce certain moral and ethical norms, in this case being fairness, right? Mm-hmm. I think you're being unfair. I'm willing to give up personal financial gain in order to punish you for being unfair. Yeah, you offered me a buck. I'm not a buck if I reject that, but it's worth it to me because you did something unfair, and I'm willing to sort of spend my own money to enforce those social norms or those ethical ideas of fairness. I think and that's consistent across these sorts of things. So we are not purely rationally self-interested in that sense. We have a sense of fairness, and we're willing to sort of put forth some capital in order to enforce those things. Yes.
This $10 to start with is a gift to begin with.
It right? is, yes.
Okay, yeah. So it's something you wouldn't have otherwise anyway. Mm-hmm. And I think that changes the texture quite a bit.
Yeah.
That's $10 that I earn. I'm going to be a lot more careful with what happens with that $10.
That's a really interesting idea. I want to come back to that point in just a couple minutes. But everybody hear that the way the game is set up here matters a lot, I think. Yeah.
Is it always a take it or leave it game? Or if I said, look, I will offer you two. And she says, that sucks.
Can you negotiate?
Unless you give me at least three, I'm going to reject your offer and you'll get none.
Yeah.
And I'll say, okay, $250.
Like I said, this game has been done tens of thousands of times with all sorts of different variations. There's also a variation, it's called the dictator game, where the person just gives and there's no opportunity except to reject. And still, the offers are still, they're lower, but they still tend to be $2, $3 in that sort of range. So, I mean, there are lots of ways to do this and you get slightly different outcomes, but you see the same sort of motivations behind them, I think.
I think the interesting dynamic about this variant, too, is that we both have power in the situation. Like, yeah. I can totally screw him out of all the money if I want to. And so that, I feel, changes the dynamic considerably when you have a knowledge in your rationalizing of power.
Mm-hmm. What happens if the recipient, the one receiving the gift from me, doesn't know what the magnitude of the gift was that I received in the first place?
That's a good question. I don't actually know. I mean, I'm sure it's been tried. But
if you gave me $100, but you didn't tell him that, yeah. And I give him $4, is he going
to think it would be more difficult for them to assess the fairness of the offer, right? And so you'd probably get my hunch is you'd get acceptance at a much lower rate if you don't know. But that's a really interesting question. I just don't know.
I mean, that's a big problem in the society, isn't it? Because we have people with mega incomes that we presume could have given us mega dollars, and they don't give us mega dollars, and they tick at them for not giving us mega dollars. But if we didn't know what their assets were, and they gave us more than our daily income, we'd be ecstatic.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I'm just going to say that the power dynamic here is not only knowledge of how this game is going to be played, but if in real life, when you don't feel like you have any way to, when you're a desperate person, put it that way, when you're so economically disadvantaged as the gift from the recipient's point of view, you don't feel like you can reject it because you have no choice.
That's a really interesting point too. There's a certain privilege in the ability to reject what you consider an unfair offer. I think that's a really interesting point.
I also wonder what would happen if instead of us sitting next to each other, we were on opposite sides of like a wall and there was just a sort of point of exchange.
I do know what happens when you do that. This game is often done online on computers where you can't see the person you're playing with. And what would you expect happens?
Offers go down.
Nice. Offers go down, and it changes the dynamic. Again, if you can't look face to face. Well, let's move to the offer side for just a second. So, from the receiver's side, we see a willingness to enforce ideas of fairness and things like that. From the offeror side, what's going on here? Do we see, are you motivated in your offer by rational self-interest, or are there other motives going on there? Some of you mentioned you're motivated by fairness. Others said, well, I thought this is as little as I could get away with. That sort of sounds like rational self-interest, right? So what's happening there?
Well, I think it's a combination. You know, you come up with something, you're trying to get to fairness because you want them to accept it. Mm-hmm. I mean, if there wasn't, they didn't have to accept it, and you wouldn't get, the money doesn't go away. That's a whole different environment. But where they need to accept it, it's kind of like, my rational self-interest gets overridden a bit by trying to get something that I can explain.
And you're using your knowledge of the ethical context
to
advance your own self-interest.
Yeah, your self-interest, so you can get to the point where they actually will accept it.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
But also, if you know the person, it's any transaction is almost by definition not a one-off transaction. You have to consider how pissed off they might be if you didn't offer them enough, and you will subsequently suffer in some other context.
Well, I do know how that comes out too. If you play this game repeatedly with the same person, you know that's going to happen. What do you think happens? The offers, they go way up, right? And that's an interesting point, because I think it gets into the question that's motivating this class today. So as we become an economy of strangers, I always expect to do business with the same person again. I don't even always know who I'm doing business with, right? And so does a market system like that change our behavior, you know? So here's the problem, which I think this game illustrates in an interesting way, is that we are motivated both by rational self-interest, but also by sort of altruism or sense of justice or fairness. And these things are sort of wrapped together in complicated ways when we take actions, right? We're motivated by different things, by both self-interest and altruism. And so, which of these motives prevail? Okay, this is where the interesting kind of psychology and neuroscience that I've been reading about comes in. And there's an idea out there that our ethicality, is that a word? That we can sort of turn it on and off, or
it is
not. Well, you know what I mean, right?
Yeah.
So, and not that you can turn it on and off, but it's almost like a volume, right? You can turn your ethicality up or down, and we tend to do that based on the context. And some of you brought up this idea of context. So the idea I want to explore is how the social context, especially a capitalist or market context, affects our level of ethicality. Does it turn it down or does it turn it up? Some of you may have heard this story, but there's this really interesting study that was done, and it's become kind of a famous study in this area of economics, involving a daycare center in Haifa, Israel. So what was happening was, many of you, maybe take your children to daycare, so you're supposed to pick them up at 5 o'clock, and they're watching your kids till you get there, but parents often get caught in traffic or caught at work, or they come a little late, right? And so what was happening was the daycare center providers were ending up having to stay a little past 5 as parents were late, okay? And so some researchers, some economists heard about this and said, hey, let's go in and see what happens. So what we did was say, okay, they instituted a new rule that said, if you are late picking up your child from daycare, you have to pay for it, X amount for every 5 minutes you're late, or something. Let's observe what happens. What do you think happened?
We got later.
I'm trying to pick up.
You're right on. So the amount of late pickups went up dramatically, like on many multiples, right? Which is very, going back to Econ 101, if we're rationally self-interested, it violates what we call the law of demand. Price goes up, quantity goes down, right? You'd think as you charge people for something, they're going to do less of it. But exactly the opposite happened, and it was dramatic. Why?
Because they didn't price it right.
Okay, so one answer would be the price just wasn't high enough, but that still doesn't explain why, on the margin, going from zero to something positive didn't reduce it. I think it's, yeah.
As a parent, the hours for daycare do not work for the parent's work schedule, so you are happy to pay the extra knowing that you're going to be late regardless.
But wouldn't you be even happier knowing that the charge was zero? But you could, your people were late before for nothing.
I'd be happy to pay for nothing, but at the same time, if, the other thing is the guilt factor. When you walk in knowing that you're late and you're looking at the person, they're looking at you like, I've been changing your kid's dirty diaper all day, and you're showing up late, at least now you have that satisfaction of, I just paid you extra.
Okay. Ooh. Yeah. Other observations, I think.
I mean, that's very similar, just that you created a market for it. When you didn't know it was an option before, like it wasn't, it wasn't a sanctioned action before. Maybe people were actually on it, like accidentally getting there late, and now it's sort of this, it's now an option. It's become there's a market for it.
Yeah, so you know, before the price, what motivates a parent to get there on time?
Sense of fairness for the workers.
Right, exactly. There's a certain care for the workers. It's a sense of fairness, a sense, maybe guilt, a sense of obligation. There's a sort of moral or ethical motivation to get there on time. Okay? Yeah.
It depends on your daycare. Like if you're a Title 10 or whatever that is, and it's a daycare for moms that are working two jobs and don't have any money, mm-hmm. they're barely able to. You know, have it be a subsistence existence. And it depends on what kind of daycare you have.
It may, again, but yeah, the context matters a lot. Yeah. So, yeah.
So I'm wondering if you were to continue the study further and then triple the amount, of time in relationship to what they were late, what the response would be socially then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting question. They didn't do that.
But. Whether or not they would lose business as a result, and thinking, well, these people aren't empathetic to, you know, the problems with traffic or, you know, the demands of my boss.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Were there consequences before for being late? If they were late consistently, perhaps you'd say, take your child elsewhere.
Yeah, or just, you know, what if they just said, you know, you've been coming late, this is, you know, our teachers have to stay, they want to get home to their families too, and they have to stay because you're late, will you please come? You know, it's like, oh, I feel terrible about that, right? But as soon as you put a dollar amount on it, what happens? What's the signal? What's the message?
It's okay.
It's no, this is no longer a moral or ethical relationship. It's now a market relationship, and as long as I pay for it, it's okay. Right? Notice the dial of ethicality just changed as soon as you put a price on something. And I think that is a fascinating question that we could expand into lots of different things. Right? When our relationships become more market based, does it change? The moral relationship, the ethical relationship between people. The game we just played a little while ago is called the ultimatum game, and it's usually phrased in terms of offers and receivers, but it's also been tried by people. They call it, the game is identical, they call it the market game, and they identify the people as the sellers and the buyers. That's the only difference. And the amount offered goes way down, and the amount that people, the level at which people start rejecting also goes way down. So the point is that the way we frame things, as soon as we start framing things as a market relationship, as soon as we put a price on things, it changes the frame, it changes the context, and it changes the way we start interacting with each other. And I find that really, really interesting.
From a provider's standpoint, dealing with the daycare issue, if there's a lot of competition in the area, a barn, whatever. It's quite possible that changing your pattern by having more money required could be something that marketing-wise makes you a stronger person in that market.
Mm-hmm. It could be. I mean, yeah. I mean, you can. You know, this is kind of what I want to get at a little bit. Is that you can, to some degree, the way you frame things up. Change the nature of your relationship. You could rely on people's sense of obligation, or you could just say, hey, we're good. This is truly a purely market thing, and let people self-select into, you know, which direction they're going to go. That could be an effective way to go at this.
So yeah, I'm really curious. So the daycare did this to try and stop parents showing up late.
Well, actually, I should be clear. It wasn't the daycare center that decided to do this. It was a bunch of economic researchers who said, hey, let's try this and see what happens. So,
okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
One little kind of often a red herring direction.
direction. Kind of the psychological effect on the child of being left longer. I know our kids hated that. You know, the guilt there on me, I've got to get there because he's feeling left.
I hadn't thought of that actually. That's a really interesting point. I mean, the way we're talking about it, it seems like the obligation to the teacher is greater than the obligation to the child. So yeah. That's interesting. So let me ask you another question. This is a hypothetical question, but I've used versions of this with my students, and they unanimously sort of agree. Obviously, what do you think? So, you know, you've seen the disabled parking signs and parking spots that are near buildings. And, you know, if you park there, there's a fine. So just imagine, I know the fines are bigger than this, but imagine you park in a disabled parking spot, there's a $10 fine. If you get a ticket, it's a $10 fine. Okay, so that's one system. Okay. What if, alternatively, we set up a system where they were not called disabled parking spots, but they were called permit parking spots, and for $10, you could get a permit to park there. But if you were disabled, you got the permit for free. Which system is better?
For who?
That's a good question. What do you think? I mean, so let me back. So, are they financially? Are they any different? If you're disabled, how much does it cost you to park there?
Nothing
under either system. And if you're not and you park there, what does it cost you? $10
under either zero.
Under either system.
Usually zero if you don't get a ticket.
Oh yeah, okay, that's true. But let's assume you're going to get caught. But it would be the same. The enforcement would be the same. Did I buy a permit or do I have the little thing on my license plate? Right. So those things would cancel each other out. But,
it's a one-time permit.
Yeah.
One-time parking permit.
Should we have a preference for one system over the other? I mean, financially, they are more or less the same. And if you're in an Econ 101 class and you're looking at people as rationally self-interested, one might say, yeah, they're the same, it doesn't matter. Well, my students always tell me, yeah, it matters a lot. So I don't know what you think, yeah.
If your policy was to make sure that there were more spaces available for disabled people, you wouldn't want to have non-disabled people be able to be part, to take that spot in lieu of their, I mean, wouldn't it cut down the number of spots if that might be available at any given time.
Which one would cut down the number?
If you could do permit for non-disabled people and use the same spot that a disabled person would otherwise use. So I mean, from that perspective, it's definitely disadvantaged, I think, to the disabled person of not having that capacity much more frequently.
Using the permit system. I think I agree with you, right? That if we use the permit system, more non-disabled people would park in that spot. But the financial incentives are exactly the same, so why? Is the ethical frame of those two sets of rules different? You know, using the $10 fine, what's the message? What's the signal that policy sends you?
You're a lawbreaker, and the other one, you're a law abider.
If you park here, you're a lawbreaker. Are you harming anyone?
If I buy a permit, I'm a law abider.
As I follow the rules, I'm okay, right?
Amazing.
Yeah. Right. So the first one, the fine seems to send a message that this spot is not for you. It's for other people, and there's a good reason why we're sending it to them. And if you take it from them, you're doing something wrong, right? The other one, the permit system, says, well, if this is more of a market transaction, if you pay the fee, it's okay, right? Again, it takes it out of the ethical context and puts it into a market context. And it's like, although the financial incentives are exactly the same, it may change our behavior.
You could flip that over, because I've known disabled people that keep using the thing longer than they're supposed to be having it up there.
Yeah.
So they can there.
Yeah, I have to admit,
so
I've done that. When I was in college, I had over a J-term, or interim, I guess you call it. We call it J-term over there. I had surgery in my feet, so I got one of those little stickers, and I healed faster than I expected. I kept this, it was January, it was so nice to be able to drive from my dorm up to Old Main, and that's why I kept it on my window for a little bit longer than I should have. But then I get on that lift in case anybody was looking, right?
And you're carrying that guilt into
To this day, 30 years later, I still feel a little bit bad about that.
It wasn't worth it?
Yeah. It's really cold up there on top of that hill in January. The reason I bring this up is because this comes up in real, my example is hypothetical, but a real world example of that is has to do with climate change. So we talk a lot about cap and trade systems as a way to reduce carbon emissions, right? And many ethicists have said, you know, a cap and trade system says if you buy a permit, you're allowed to emit carbon, okay? Ethicists have said that's not the right way to do that. We should fine people who emit. We should set carbon limits, and if you do it, we should fine you, because it is a different ethical context. And as soon as you call it a permit system, although financially, incentive-wise, you know, it's the exact same thing. And from an economic standpoint, I teach my students that a tax and a permit system are exactly the same in terms of incentives. But is the moral frame the same? If we say, okay, you know, coal-burning power plants, if you have purchased enough permits, it's okay. Is that different than saying, if you exceed your carbon limits, we're going to fine you? Do you see a difference there?
Yeah. I mean, it's different. We're now talking about not individuals, but corporations, and I think the idea is, like, if you were a human who acted like a corporation, you'd be a sociopath. And, like, because I do think that there isn't really, I don't know, like, if you were to do, like, the offer acceptance thing with corporations, it'd be different. But I would imagine it would be different, because, like, they are, by definition, like, profit maximizers rather than sort of ethical beings.
Yeah, but I think that's a really good point. Does the frame affect corporations differently than people, individuals, I should say? Probably quite a bit, actually. Yeah.
Because we follow that back, though, we're all sociopaths by that definition, because we could all reduce our carbon footprint if we tried, but we don't try.
But the practicalities of the two approaches are very different.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, if you set a limit on carbon and you've got, say, 20% of the emitters who are already over that limit, so their choice is to pay some big fine or shut down or curtail their operations, that has a lot of ripple effects. Whereas if you do a cap and trade where they can actually buy the right to stay in business, you know, you're keeping people in their jobs at those plants and you're giving them an incentive to invest in capital over time to reduce their emission. I mean, I think the practicalities of cap and trade, including the enforcement mechanisms of actually taking somebody to court and trying to levy a fine and having this administrative overhead, it's supposed to be, you know, the self-interest motives of the cap and trade system are more self-policing than
fine. The details are far more complicated, right, than I made them out to be. But I mean, your point about, you know, should we be trying? I mean, the question I find really interesting is, does one policy or one way to frame up the question, is it a fine, is it a permit, does that affect our moral motivation to try? You know, and maybe that doesn't affect corporations, but you know, maybe it does.
Another way to put it, what if it was an incentive?
Yeah.
And so, like, where you get a credit to buy an electric vehicle, right? As opposed to you get fined for buying a gas-burning vehicle. How does that level the playing field, or how does that work?
Yeah.
At one point, I think on a fee versus a fine, There is an incentive from a tax deduction standpoint, because a fine is typically not deductible.
Yeah.
But a fee would be, like a cap and trade fee probably would be. So it's just it's one other piece of the puzzle.
In today's world with concern for corporate citizenship and ability to publicize people who are being fined and things like that, does give boardroom a lot more concern to make sure that they're not paying fines, whereas they might be willing to pay the same amount of money for a fee or, you know, for a cap and trade capability. They don't want that black mark of actually having been fined and taking it away.
And it's a black mark because we view that as something that's more morally wrong, right? There was a there have been lots of rules lately about plastic bags. Some cities in California have plastic bags now. Ireland did it not too long ago. They put a tax or fee or penalty in plastic bags. And unlike the daycare center problem, plastic bag consumption went down 95% or something like that. And I think that the difference between that one and the daycare problem is the way they framed it up. I think when Ireland did it, they said, we are putting this tax on plastic bags because these bags are really bad. They're getting in the ocean, they're polluting. It is our moral obligation to not do this anymore. And we're gonna back up that sort of moral purpose with a fee, right? I mean, what would have happened if the daycare center had said, we're gonna start charging you if you come late? And the reason is that our teachers really want to get home to their families. And this is unfair for people to come late. And to sort of lay out the moral argument and then say, and we're gonna back it up with the press, would that have changed behavior? Maybe that would have resulted in a different outcome. What I'm talking about here is a sort of category of things that economists refer to as crowding out. So the question is, does putting a price on something crowd out our moral obligation? The argument I'm trying to make, and I'm trying to get rid of the buzz, the argument I'm trying to explore a little bit is, does a price send a signal that this is no longer a moral obligation, it's just a market transaction? And I think when we talk about how we interact with each other in the context of markets, we should be thinking about that. Another argument for crowding out, just very briefly, and then I have a couple of other things I want to raise. Some people have speculated that as soon as you put a price on something, that your internal reward, let me give you an example. So we live in a neighborhood in Decorah with lots of small kids, and we're all really good friends up and down the street. And so our neighbors right next door have small twins, right? And for obvious reasons, they want to get out of the house every once in a while. And so, they've dropped the kids off at our house. Can we just go for a walk? And we're happy to do that, right? But, if my neighbor comes and says, we take care of their kids while they go for a walk, and I say, oh, can we pay you for that? I feel a little offended by it, right? And I would, if they were going to hire me as their babysitter, I wouldn't do it. I have no interest in making money as a babysitter. There are far easier ways to make money than as a babysitter, right? So if they were to pay me, I have no interest in watching their children. But if they say, oh, we're exhausted, we want to go down and have a beer, can our kids play for an hour, I'm happy to do it, right? And so the idea is, I might be internally motivated to do the right thing initially, but as soon as you put a price on something, now all of a sudden it's the reward is the motivation rather than the act itself, and it somehow undermines our desire to do the right thing. Does that ring true? Yeah?
Yeah, I've said they couldn't pay me enough to paint Lodge 4.
But if someone says, hey, you want to go out and paint for a few hours this afternoon? You're like, sure.
Painted Lodge 4. Yeah. Pay me enough. Yeah.
Come back to small community.
Yes. And I wonder, many of us work for nonprofits. I would never say that in front of our CFO or our regents, but I wonder if there's that. What if we paid teachers at liberal arts colleges more? I wonder if that would change things. We're notoriously underpaid, and we complain about it all the time. But the people I work with are there because we really believe in the mission of the college, and we like our students. If the wage was higher, would we attract people who are motivated by the wage? And would it change the community? And many of you have probably worked in nonprofits. I think these questions are at the heart of that kind of thing. Does a price change our motivation, and does it change the way we interact with each other?
I'm going to say that in a lot of societies, you create obligation. So by watching your neighbor's kids, there is a an understood creation of an obligation on their part to do something good for you at some point in the future. Not necessarily specified.
Pro quo, yeah.
Culturally understood.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that these things get very, very circular, and they get very vicious as well.
Yeah, so there are elements of self-interest wrapped up in that, as well as altruism, yeah.
Mm-hmm. In one community we lived in, we had a babysitting cult, and, you know, so we could kind of trade with other people back and forth, and, you know, kind of eliminated the guilt of imposing on your neighbor. You know, people were all pretty much friends. They kind of had the same values as far as discipline and so forth. And, you could go volunteer and not be out a bunch of money for babysitting.
Yeah. It's
cool.
It is cool. It's cool. It's very different than the daycare center for, you know, fee by hour, kind of come out, right? It changes things.
So I think sometimes in nonprofits, though, you tend to have a lower-paid executive director, but then a person comes along with so many good qualifications that you feel obligated to pay more, and you definitely get more, even though the salary may have doubled, you get more for the value.
Yeah. I don't know the answer to my question about that.
Some people are so good. They do so much that it's worth it.
Yeah. Okay, just a few minutes left. I want to just throw out some ideas about the other side of this. You know, because we are becoming a large, complex world, and we do have to interact with people we don't know. You know, the question that comes up, can we rely on altruism and cooperation and goodwill toward others to govern our relationships? Or do our systems, our capitalism, give us a set of rules that allow us to work better together? And the best example of that I can think of is the European Union. Didn't you know the origins of the European Union? It was first formed in the, I think, early 1950s as the European Steel and Coal Community or something like that. And the idea, it started between Germany and France after World War II, and the idea was that if we can integrate our steel and coal industries, and so that we are forced to trade with each other and forced to rely on each other, we can no longer fight with each other. And so the idea was that economic integration would make it far too costly to go to war. That was the basis of the whole European Union, and it is still a part of the purpose of the European Union. But at the heart of that is this idea that a system of trade actually could sort of overcome our bad angels, you know, rather than undermine our good angels. So, but what do you think of that? In a world with 6-7 billion people, however many we have, the world is complicated. Are there benefits of a capitalist system?
It sounds to me like it's kind of falling apart, because Turkey has tried for years and years and years to be part of the EU, and they were never accepted, and now things are kind of falling apart.
Yeah, the European Union is under a lot of stress right now.
Yeah.
But if you believe that there are things in our economic institutions, if there are elements of capitalism that maybe will help us get along better, then that gives you another reason to try to save the European Union, right? To try to overcome those things. I wonder what the rest of you think. Yeah.
No, I think I agree to some degree, but that view of things kind of really removes the scope from like the individuals that actually is doing the work on it. And I think we can agree like war is bad, but if the alternative is like today's modern trade, like, well, okay, let's say like the US, we can have a good relationship with Southeastern Asian countries because they're producing a lot of our goods and we're paying them, but that doesn't translate to goodwill to the actual individuals producing this stuff. And I think when, like, I don't know what coal and oil stuff were like back in the 50s or whatever, but I think today it maybe worked on a geopolitical scale to avoid war, but it doesn't. I think if your goal in preventing war is encouraging like human rights, then it's not succeeding in that element. Or at least maybe you can say, okay, sweatshops are better than sending people off to die, but that's not like the priority in that relationship. The priority is cheap goods.
And so if our focus is on individual morality or individual relationships, so you still undermine that? Is it,
yeah, I mean, it's not solving the problem. It maybe avoids war, but that's not the priority in that relationship is prioritizing human rights.
Yeah.
There's a absolutely cause and effect where capitalism and trade has diminished conflict. Just a few years ago, India and Pakistan were in brinksmanship for nuclear war, and they're both nuclear power, yeah? And a lot of companies use India and Bangalore for back office work and a lot of interpretation of medical imagery. And those people in Europe and the United States were working then, because this was getting nasty, were going to second source into Indonesia, the Philippines, and other countries, and that business was going to leave India. And the business community in India said to the politicians in India, cool it, sit on it, don't do it. And the nuclear standoff abated. So this is where trade matters. And back to the steel and coal in Europe, absolutely. You know, if you integrate economies, it becomes so expensive to go to war, because all the supply chain breaks down.
And I was told that one of the reasons why Turkey isn't being accepted in the EU is because they are denying their attempt for Armenian genocide in the past. And so I'm wondering, in relationship to economic integration in regards to war, whether or not the rest of Europe, and I don't know the answer to this, whether or not the rest of Europe is looking at this past conflict and saying, no, you're not owning up to the mistakes of the past as Germany has. And perhaps this is one of the reasons why they're not included.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that either. It's an interesting question.
Follow up on the comment over here. What the trade has done, I think, is actually it's raised the threshold of what it would cost to make people in leadership willing to do something like go to war. By raising that cost, it makes it their own political equation, it changes the political equation. At some point, they will decide that it's worth throwing all of that away to get what I want. And I think what happened with Yugoslavia is probably a really good example of that. They gave up a lot to fracture that place. But some of them were willing to pay the price. And so I think that what the EU has done is really good, and it has raised that threshold quite a bit.
I think you also have to kind of look at different types of trade. So like a more reliant trade, like a trade on like natural gas going out of Russia into all of its former states, which they're reliant on those pipelines, like Lithuania and Ukraine and so forth. And so that, I think that caused everybody in the whole region to kind of cool their heels a bit and not react as violently as they might have to the Ukrainian situation, because they're totally reliant on it. Now they've got the Freedom Ship, and they've got the other things coming in. They have other sources of natural gas that's coming from Norway and from the United States. But that just caused everybody to say, whoa, we're gonna have a huge issue because we have a cold winter coming. And Russia's raising the price like crazy, but we have no choice.
So as I listen to these comments near the end of the time, so make a few final comments. But what I hear when you talk about trade and things is most of the comments say, well, I think sort of economic integration is good for that war because the self-interest forces us to act as if we care about each other, whether or not we actually care about each other. And I think that's very different than what we started the discussion with, right? I think the way that markets interact with our ethics and moral obligations is a really fascinating one. We're sort of at the beginning, like I said, of understanding this, and there's a lot of really cool research in psychology and neuroscience that's working on this. But I think there's great promise in when we talk about things like the Irish bank tax, a great promise in designing policy in a way that avoids undermining our existing ethical obligations and maybe in fact bolsters them, or recognizes those places where we don't actually care about each other, but maybe we can create incentives to make us act as if we do. And I think recognizing the complexity of how we are both selfish and unselfish at the same time in complicated ways is really sort of promising and interesting way to think about how these things work together.
I know you're trying to wrap up.
Yeah, but I won't force it. I won't force it upon you.
Is the elephant in the room of present movement about tariffs initiated by the United States, is that anything you'd like to go towards as far as your, I mean, you're the one that supposedly can see the bigger picture for us lay people.
Yeah,
I know what's going on.
What I don't see is not necessarily how it ties into what we've been talking about in ethics and morality this morning. What I do see is that it is probably a really bad thing.
Yeah.
I don't see many positives.
Well,
about
if
it
you're
actually.
Saying it's a bad thing, you're starting to talk ethics and morality.
I don't know how much I want to get into this, but you know, if we sort of add up the economic pros and cons, the cons seem to exceed pros. But what I don't know is how this approach to international relations is going to sort of affect those relationships.
Right.
That's what I have a hard time understanding. I have a hunch, but.
Well, if you've got a few more minutes, I mean, I think the question is a good one.
Yeah.
The issue has been framed in terms of trade deficits, basically saying that's a losing situation for the United States to be in a trade deficit relationship with another country, which is such a not even sophomoric view of economics.
Yeah.
But most people just see that sort of the black and white of, if you're in a trade deficit, you're losing. But you know, meanwhile, you know, our budget deficit is gigantic, and essentially, you know, our trade deficit is financing our budget deficit in a way. But that connection is lost on most people. For example, I mean, it's a very complicated area, of course, but it's not black and white as to whether a trade deficit is detrimental.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think the most economists don't worry a lot about it. A trade deficit, if it's there for the right reasons.
Well, and also, you know, the trade deficit is only part of the overall
right.
balance
so
of
a
payments.
A small piece of that, also.
Because we're importing capital like crazy, right? We have a big budget deficit that we're financing with the proceeds of the money we're shipping over to all these other countries because they're investing back in U.S. government bonds and financing our budget deficit. So there's no black and white answer here, and a lot of people think there is a black and white answer.
But here, I mean, it is interesting that you raise this because, while getting into specifics, a policy of high tariffs or sort of a more nationalist approach to the world economy is the opposite of what the European Union was trying to do. Right, and so it does get at many of the things we've been talking about today. Is do we want greater integration? Are markets the way that we can, in a macro sense, better interact with each other, or do we need to look a little more inward and to those around us? It is not a whole lot different than the bi-local
right.
movement, right? Just on a kind of a larger scale. And so I think it's a really good point.
I'd like to, I brought up a point earlier. It seems to me that we do have two gross economic, political ideas going on now. And one very large part of that came out of James Buchanan and George Mason University and the Koch brothers and the influence that they've had on the courts and on the economics. And Buchanan, of course, was one of the early ones that won a Nobel Prize by saying that, yes, we are all totally self-interested to an extreme,
government and everything else, so government is bad. So now you have this economic sense of inequality, in a sense, is natural, and there should be no restrictions on that whatsoever. And when we talk about inequality in our society, you know, to think that it's just an economic thing, and you know, these guys are looking at it as an economic and political aspect, and they're tied very tightly together. Mm-hmm. I just don't know where we go from this
point. And there is a, you know, a very influential school of thought. Going back to Milton Friedman, who wrote a famous article that said the purpose of a corporation is to make profit. And that was the argument. So that, you know, what I'm trying to do this week is take that view that markets are always good in every circumstance and contrast that with the view that markets are always bad under all circumstances and recognize that neither one is actually correct, right? It's something in the middle. But I think it's important to reject, that becomes very ideological, and I think it's important to reject that and sort of recognize that it's messier.
Let's see if I can put my thoughts into words here. It feels, and I don't mean to excuse it or get complacent about it, but it feels like that this move right now is a natural pushback of people's fear over the speed of change that's happening in the world. It both in terms of information systems and the move towards a global market, that it's moving so fast that the folks who are feeling fearful of the speed of that change need to react and push back against that in some way, whether it's right or wrong and whether it's going to help or hurt. And so, you know, our whole theme here this week and this summer about fear not is then, can we recognize what's happening in these systems and with these people? And in this situation, in this context, in these times, what is God calling us to do now? I'm still not sure what the answer to that question is, but I think just trying to understand the fear and where it's coming from and what we can do. It's not hopeless. God tells us that it's not hopeless.
I agree. I'm glad you said that. And I think when the faculty were gathered talking about last night's Vespers, that was the theme that we were talking about. It's not hopeless. We are, you know, we have agency here. Society is us, and there are things we can do. What that is, I don't know, right? But I think there are things there that we can do. So keeping that sort of hopefulness, I think, is good. I'm glad you said that.
Yeah. My question isn't about tariffs. It's about something in the description of your talks that you were going to give that I don't think you touched on. And I know your time is up.
It's not my time. I've got all day. I want to respect everybody else's time. But if you want to stay and talk, you'll stay as long as you want.
In the description, it said you were very interested in how communities are able to resolve conflict between government and legal issues, the small communities, the description that I read.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe I said that. I don't know what I said. This was months ago when I wrote that. Things change.
Have you written about that, or?
I haven't really. My personal interest of sort of research and scholarship is, not to the extent that I'm a scholar at all. I am interested in these ideas of where economic systems fail and where political systems fail and how we collectively fill in the gaps and solve the problems when problems do fall through the gaps of institutions. That's kind of what I'm interested in. So, you know, collective action and cooperation is what I tend to get interested in. And so these are the sorts of questions I really, really, really like.
You don't have any
1, 2, 3
answers then.
No. If you spend much time with me, you realize I have very few answers.
And kind of in general, I think.
Yeah, on one hand.
So it's up to the community to come to some creative, imaginative decisions.
You know, we've got a politician in the room, we have others who are involved. I mean, it's politics. I mean, you can't study economics without politics, right? And so I do think that economics is a really useful way to sort of, to think about things like incentives and how we interact with each other. There are a lot of powerful ideas in economics that help us think about our institutions and how they affect people, right? But ultimately, how we change those things and shape them, it is a political question. And so those two things have to go together.
The political and the legal and the governmental, although they all have to go hand in hand, or they have to have this compromise at some point.
Yeah, it's all about compromise. We said a democracy, right?
I live in a college town, Moscow, Idaho, and run a farmer's market. And I had people in our city council think that the market was just a fluff. And then they did an economic study of the market and the millions of dollars that went through the market, which is, I would have rejected anything less than $5, because if both of us have $5, that's two times the amount of money that can be put into the economy and trading money and having money recirculating. So what also is, so I came in when someone was talking about local food. We're not talking about semi-trucks or carrots. We're talking about carrots that are grown 20 miles out of town, and I might pay more for their carrots than I can go to Winco and buy my carrots. But I think there's some ideology there, and then there's also a lot of younger people in college now that go with a movement, think with your wallet, and they don't really care that Toys R Us went down. And they don't care that our Macy's store closed in our mall, because they're thinking with their wallet, and they're more in for experience. And they might come to the market and they won't buy a case of peaches because they're not canners, but they'll buy two peaches, and then they'll develop the relationship with the grower, and then they'll become that type of shopper. So there is some ideology about local, and then there is some strength about local. And I think we need to go back 20 years when people were making jokes about organics, when now the big threat when it comes to economics is that places like Costco need to buy up the organic farms in California so they can keep their supply coming through for their market. So it one does affect another, and to go back to local, if I know the guy that's growing something that I need and I can support his business and he pays property tax in my county.
Yeah, I agree. This is a good place to wrap up then, I think, because kind of we're again circling back to where we started. So I do also do some research in food systems, and I have an interest in farmers markets, and we have a great farmers market in the core. But I think the farmers market is a great example of sort of where a market system and community relationships really complement each other really well, and how that fits into the larger system, I think, is really sort of a fascinating thing. But it's they serve a valuable purpose both economically and socially and community-wise, and finding ways to meld all those things together in a positive way, I think, is the trick here. So I do it again. I don't know, but, you know, hopefully together we can figure it out. So thanks for coming.